Sometime after his death, there was a very famous book published in 1737, and it was published by a very famous minister in Ettrick, and he was most well known up to that point for something that was, I believe, published in his lifetime called The Fourfold State of Man. If you've never read it, it is superb covenant theology. And there, right after he died, the series of sermons on Ecclesiastes 7:13, our text, was published in a famous book called The Crook in the Lot. I happen to have a very special copy of that comes from the Woodbury family over in Bedford, and I happened to pick it up in a used bookstore years ago, having once seen it in an auction, and I couldn't get my hands on it, and I was amazed to find it. They are signed in pencil by George Woodbury, and they're realizing that back in that family, there was probably real Christian faith, because Thomas Boston was one of the eminent preachers of the gospel. But I remember looking at that title and thinking, The Crook in the Lot, what does that mean? Is he referring to a thief in his woodlot? That would have been, you know, a serious problem in the 18th century, because that's how you heated your house normally. But that's not at all what he was talking about. In fact, the idea of the lot was the way that things fall out in your life. And the idea here is exactly what this is saying, is that our lives are not straight. They are a crooked pathway. They are filled with difficulties, with injustices, and with troubles. And in fact, we are told that this series of sermons that he did in typical Puritan fashion, fashioning 25 sermons out of one verse instead of 25 on a whole book. But of course, the whole book gets into it one way or another. And these sermons were forged in what Boston himself called a sea of troubles. When we meet as a session, we oftentimes know of more troubles than any one individual in the church. And it's always important for us to remember that this is the normal life of the church, that there are troubles. Everyone has their troubles. There are crooks in everyone's lot. There are difficulties that we face and things that just don't seem to be the way that they were designed to be in the original creation, which was entirely good. And so what are we to make of this? Well, I believe that we are to make of it this, that God controls the crookedness of the world. In fact, we don't have to make that of it. It says it so plainly that you can't deny it. Consider the work of God. This is what He does. Who can make straight what He has made crooked? And then the second point is a question which 16 to 18 actually gives us the answer to. How do we deal with this crookedness? What do we do about it? And so God controls the crookedness of the world. And you see, this is something that only the believer can really understand. And it's one of the many reasons why in this book, we're not looking at the preacher Q as someone who's taking the position of an unbeliever just so we can see how awful that position would be. No, he's taking the position of the believer all the way along the way and saying, this is what we face in the real world, fallen, affected so profoundly by Adam's sin. It's the believer's perspective. And sometimes we have to be prepared for what we're not used to in Scripture, some irony and some hidden meanings, some twisting of language to get us to get the point. And we encountered that especially last Lord's Day evening as we looked at 1 through 12. But now here, we see a rather bold statement. It's very plain now what he's saying is that this crookedness that you experience and the fact that somehow by living a wise life, that doesn't answer all your questions. But God is in control, and that's something you have to reckon on. It's one of the sweet things that we who are Reformed, or call ourselves Calvinists, whatever historical label you want to use, but what all believers have discovered, and certainly what the writer of Ecclesiastes knew by God's revelation, is that God is supremely and absolutely, without any qualifications, sovereign. Now, I say that without any qualifications. Our confession actually qualifies that in several ways. And it says that his absolute sovereignty and his decrees is something which is a high mystery and needs to be handled with the greatest caution and care. We are not to say that he is the author of sin, nor are we to say that our actions and all of what he calls the second causes, or what they call the second causes, are therefore made meaningless. They aren't. And he is not the author of sin, but he is the one who sovereignly controls everything that goes on in the world. And this is very important, because what it means is that he alone can be trusted. Not our works, as blessed as they may be, not our activities, not our wisdom, but God is the one to be trusted. And so he says, stop now and consider this. This is a call for serious contemplation. Stop now in the midst of all of your reflections on the injustices, the oppression, the inequities in life, and stop and know this truth, that while wisdom is insufficient, God is not. And so the work of God is really the deciding factor. He is transcendent. He says in 8:17, which will be actually the second of these three punctuations, that God's work makes it all understandable, or God's work is the thing that we can truly trust in the midst of the wackiness of the world. And he says this, I saw all the work of God, there's that phrase again, that man cannot find out the work that is done under the sun. So he's saying, we are not sufficient to figure it out. That's a tremendous relief, by the way, because we often try to. I go and talk to people who've had encountered tremendous difficulties in their lives, things that just seem like they ought not to be this way. And it's a great comfort to be able to tell them, or for them to be able to believe, that you don't have to try to figure it out. And one of the dangerous things that Christians often do is try to say that this crooked thing that's happened to me is somehow, it's because I have failed in some way. Well, one of the things Boston points out in The Crook and the Lot is that oftentimes God uses crooked things to show us where our failings really are. But that's not the same as saying that we can explain the crooked things or make them straight. And so in Ephesians 1, Paul says that in him we have obtained an inheritance, having been predestined according to the purpose of him who works, there's that word again, all things according to the counsel of his will. All, the good, the bad, the ugly, the straight, and the crooked are worked by him. And so the rhetorical question here is, who can make straight what he has made crooked? Who can do it? And of course the answer is that nobody can. It's the great issue of Christian discipleship, is that we come face to face with the reality that God is in control. And I would say that in the modern world, we have never been less disposed to come to that conclusion that we are than we are at this present time in history, because we seek control of everything. We believe that we can, even if we decide, if a man decides he wants to be a woman, he can just go to the surgeon and have it done. He can control his sex. You can control all of your destiny. If we can just figure out the map of the human genome system, we will be able to cure all diseases. These are things being said by people, by scientists, by people with PhDs, and believed by people who don't have PhDs in our day, that there is this ultimate control that is possible to man. And one of the things the Bible teaches from beginning to end in Ecclesiastes and Job drive it home as wisdom literature is that we are not in control. We never can be. We never will be. God alone is in control. And when we reckon on that fact, we have reckoned on one of the most fundamental things in the Christian or the believing life, and for us in the Christian life. God is sovereign. And he understands things that we don't understand. And in fact, things that we will never understand. We are always going to be creatures. In heaven, we will be creatures. There will be no sin. And there will be no death. And it will be glorious. but we will be learning and thinking and moving within space and time. If in some different way, we will always be locatable. There will always be a place to find me and to find you. And we will have to go there, even if on angels' wings. We will always be creatures. And God will always be mysteriously beyond us. Listen now, and I have a few readings that I wanted to interject. And two of them come from the famous hymn by William Cowper, 128, God Moves in a Mysterious Way. And here's the first two stanzas of that wonderful hymn. And remember, he was someone that struggled with severe depression. He was someone who struggled with a huge crook in his life's pathway, and it was extremely difficult. And even very near his death, there was no ultimate solution in this life to his mental disorder. But he could still, he knew this, he reckoned. These must have been especially sweet truths to him. He says, God moves in a mysterious way, his wonders to perform. He plants his footsteps in the sea and rides upon the storm. Deep in unfathomable mines of never-failing skill, he treasures up his bright designs and works his sovereign will. And this is Cowper telling us the truth about the way that God is and the kind of God, the only kind of God, really, that we can believe in. But in the modern world, we believe that we, like the Baal worshippers of old, can manipulate God through certain formulas. Now they're not sort of magical worship incantations, but they're rather mathematical and physical formulas, the formulas that will make our world a better place to live in and perfect human life. But you know what? There's still an obituary page, and there always will be, because the answer to this question is absolutely not. We cannot make the crooked straight. We may be able to do some helpful things medically and technologically to make life better in some ways, and many of those things are the gifts of God. But the fact is, God is in control, and we are not. We cannot predict our futures. And he's always interjecting this. He says in verse 14, so that man may not find out anything that will be after him. It's a punctuation of the point that we are not in control. Deuteronomy 8:3 makes a profound point that is, I just read a letter today from a very fine Christian person that misquoted this, and I always see it misquoted. 8:3 says that man does not live by bread alone, but man lives by every word that comes from the mouth of the Lord. What does that mean? Every word? Is that the Bible? Special revelation? Not at all. We're talking about bread. And the point here, it's an easy mistake to make, but the point is one of control. That we don't live by bread alone. That is, as if bread were something that we grow it and we bake it and we eat it. It's all our activity. It's under our control. But the word here is God's providential word. And that's a powerful verse, you see, for the modern world. That it's God who does all these things. And even God is there at the bottom of your email. Now, sometimes the devil gets in there too. But you see what I'm saying is he enables us to invent these things. He enables us to breathe. He enables the world to continue on because he is the one that has the ultimate control of all things. And we are to reckon on this. And he controls the blessings and the cursings of life in order to curb our sense of control. And so in verse 14, that's exactly what he says. In the day of prosperity, be joyful. And in the day of adversity, consider. God has made both of them, one as well as the other. The English commentator, Kidner, says that he clips the wings of our self-sufficiency. And see, that's just what the devil's temptation to Jesus in the wilderness was. He says, make bread out of these stones, as if he, as a man in his humanity, had complete control. Now, as God, he could have made bread out of the stones at a word of command. But he chose not to because he was living as a man to obey in our place. And so he was saying to the devil, no, you as a creature, that was your fall. And I, as the second Adam, will not do this to act as if I am in control, but in fact God is in control. And so we are called then to accept the God-ordained limits of our own mortality. And as Paul tells the Athenians in Acts 17, he says, he made from one man every nation of mankind to live on all the face of the earth, having determined allotted periods and the boundaries of their habitation, of their dwelling place, that they should seek God in the hope that they might feel their way toward him and find him. Yet he is actually not far from each one of us. He's actively involved in the control of history. And so in verse 15 now, he says, now, so take a look at the crook. Take a look at the crooked part of life. And then he states two obvious contradictions. And he says, this is what I've seen. Now, in my vain life, and this would be another way, remember the word vain is hebel, or out of whack life. I've seen everything. So he's saying, in my life, which has been kind of crazy, and not there's no straight line equation here of success and goodness, this is what I've seen. And I've seen these contradictions. That the righteous man perishes in his righteousness. He dies early, in other words. And then that the wicked prolong their life while they're doing evil. And of course, this is not the way things ought to be. And if you look at the Mosaic order and Proverbs, listen to what they say. Deuteronomy 4:40 says, you shall keep his statutes and his commandments, which I command you today, that it may go well with you and with your children after you, that you may prolong your days, and in the land that the Lord gives you, is giving you for all time. That's the ideal. In fact, prolong your days, it's really a picture of the ultimate prolonging, which is eternal life. But what happens? The righteous die young. The righteous are killed by the wicked. I knew an elder down in Philadelphia who was a godly man, and they found his body in a body bag, in a trash heap, in one of the bad sections of Philly. These things should not happen, but they do. And God is in control of them. And then Proverbs 10:27, the fear of the Lord prolongs life, but the years of the wicked shall be short. But he's just said that he's seen wicked people live long and prosperous lives. The writer of Psalm 73 almost drives himself to insanity because he looks and sees that the wicked don't even die with trouble in their hearts or on their faces. And yet he struggles all his life. And then, of course, he goes into the sanctuary and he discovers that they will one day be judged and punished for their wickedness. So it's not an even course. And we are therefore to accept our mortality before God. Listen to what the writer George Herbert says, and this particularly to make the point that God has made, he's made things in history, allowed things to become not according to their original design in order to humble us. And listen to what George Herbert says in The Pulley. These are just the last two stanzas of a four-stanza poem, one of his most famous and one that I quoted in the second sermon of this series. He says, for if I should, said he, bestow this jewel also on my creature, he would adore my gifts instead of me and rest in nature, not the God of nature. For both should be losers. So both should be losers. Yet let him keep the rest, but keep them with repining restlessness. Let him be rich and weary, that at least if goodness lead him not, yet weariness may toss him to my breast. And we made the point in that sermon and have made this point along the way, that the Lord wants us for himself. And he has so ordered history that that is what he will get. He will get a whole humanity of God lovers who know his grace and know his glory. And so what do we do with this crookedness? Well, 16 to 18 gives what appears at first to be puzzling advice. In fact, it would seem like just the wrong advice. Don't be too righteous. Don't be too wicked. Those are strange sayings. And I think what the writer is saying here is be humble in your imperfect condition. Clearly, the whole Bible tells us that we're not saying that we shouldn't seek righteousness or wisdom. But we know that if we think we have progressed farther than we have, we will fall into the worst of sins, which is pride. And then, overly wicked, he's not saying it's okay to be a little wicked, but just letting us know that we're probably more wicked than we think. We have sin. And so he's saying that what will really help you to steer a clear course through all of your imperfections is one thing and one thing only. And that is the advice that he gives us in verse 18, that we should fear God. It is a good thing, he says, that you should grab hold of this truth, that fearing God will enable you to steer a course between the Scylla of self-righteousness and the Charybda of thinking you have no wickedness. You will be able to press on through the oppressions and the wackiness of life by fearing and knowing God. And here, this is the fear which comes from faith. It's not the fear which comes from the quaking before his judgment, but it's the fear that comes through believing that God is truly in control and that he truly is gracious in his dealings with us. This is the only way, brothers and sisters, for us to deal with crookedness, the crookedness of this world. He is in control. And it's what Peter says now when we get into the New Testament. We see that this wisdom comes really into its own. And he says, humble yourselves, therefore, under the mighty hand of God, so that at the proper time he may exalt you, casting all of your anxieties upon him, because he cares for you. God knows that we have anxieties. He orders a world in which we will be tempted to be anxious in order that we might learn to fear him. He has ordered it in just that way. In Ecclesiastes 3:14, remember, he said, I perceive that whatever God does endures forever. Nothing can be added to it and nothing can be taken from it. God has done it, so the people fear before him. And then in 5:7, for when dreams increase and words grow many, there is vanity. But God is the one you must fear. So he is there all along the way saying, this is the way to rise above the Hebel, to rise above the wackiness, the oppression, the difficulties, the things that cause us anxiety, as Peter says, to cast our cares upon him. And notice that he says, we humble ourselves under the mighty hand of God. It's the God who spread the stars across the sky in the original creation. It's the God who brings billions of tons of snow onto the high Sierras in a night. It's the God who is in control of the universe and the details of our lives. And he has, in a very real way and in a profound way, made the crooked straight in Jesus Christ. There's a straight line equation in his obedience, because he has come into this world and resisted the devil and obeyed God to perfection, demonstrating his love towards God, his neighbor, and all of God's elect in a way that no other before him had done and no other after him will do. He has made straight. In fact, righteousness is straightness. Straightness, that's what it really means. If we are right with God, it means we are straight with him. We are we are meeting the standard of his way of that he has called us to live. And of course we know that that's why we need Jesus' rightness, his straightness applied, imputed to our accounts. And then that straightness is what saves us by his amazing grace. But now the righteousness of God has been manifested apart from the law, although the law and the prophets bear witness to it, the righteousness of God through faith in Jesus Christ for all who believe. And so then this rightness of Jesus has done what else? It's actually has righted all that is wrong with the world. It has not only righted sin, but it has righted death. And in his resurrection body, there is a blessedness that comes from his obedience as the Son incarnate. And that blessedness is what we have to look forward to, a world in which there one day will be no more Hebel. There will be no more crookedness. The crook will be taken completely out of the lot of our lives. And he, and we must believe this, works the crooked things in our lives for our own ultimate good, in order to get our attention, in order to get us to trust him, in order to get us to trust the wonderful righteousness of the Lord Jesus, and in order to bring us ultimately to heaven. The final thing, as we consider fearing God and the importance of growing in our trust in the midst of difficulties of him, Cooper says in the last verses of his famous hymn, "Ye fearful saints, fresh courage take. The clouds ye so much dread are big with mercy and shall break in blessings on your head. Judge not the Lord by feeble sense, but trust him for his grace. Behind a frowning providence, he hides a smiling face. His purposes will ripen fast, unfolding every hour. The bud may have a bitter taste, but sweet will be the flower. Blind unbelief is sure to err and scan his work in vain. God is his own interpreter, and he will make it plain." And think about this, even in the life of Cooper, who suffered so much from really debilitating clinical depression, he could never have written those words for us were it not for that crook in his lot. And so we don't know what the crook in our lot is for, but we know ultimately that God, who is ultimately good and sovereign and kind at once, orchestrates it all for the good of his people and for the glory of his great name. Better is the little that the righteous has than the abundance of many wicked. For the arms of the wicked shall be broken, but the Lord upholds the righteous. And then in Psalm 73, and remember this was the psalm where the psalmist is so troubled by the prosperity of the wicked, and he says, "But when I thought how to understand this, it seemed to me a wearisome task until I went into the sanctuary of God, and then I discerned their end." He knew exactly what perspective to put on it when he went and worshiped this sovereign Lord, this one who controls our lives in every way. And so, rejoice and consider. In a sense, we close with what he said at the beginning when he says, "In the day of prosperity, be joyful." He's not being ironic there. He's saying when God blesses us, enjoy it. We enjoy it, but consider when adversity comes that he also controls and sends that as well. And we trust him through the clouds, knowing that he is truly in Christ, smiling upon us, and his great love will see us through.